Chapter 5 Larry Underwood pulled around the corner and found a parking space big enough for the Datsun Z between a fire hydrant and somebody's trash can that had fallen into the gutter. There was something unpleasant in the trash can, and Larry tried to tell himself that he really hadn't seen the stiffening dead cat and the rat gnawing at its white-furred belly. The rat was gone so fast from the sweep of his headlights that it really might not have been there. The cat, however, was fixed in stasis. And, he supposed, killing the Z's engine, if you believed in one, you had to believe in the other. Didn't they say that Paris had the biggest rat population in the world? All those old sewers. But New York did well, too. And if he remembered his misspent youth well enough, not all the rats in New York City went on four legs. And what the hell was he doing parked in front of this decaying brownstone, thinking about rats, anyway? 5 days ago, on June 14th, he had been in sunny Southern California, home of hopheads, freak religions, the only C&W nightclubs in the world with go-go dancers, and Disneyland. This morning at 4:15, he had arrived on the shore of the other ocean, paying his toll to go across the Triborough Bridge. A sullen drizzle had been falling. Only in New York can an early summer drizzle seem so unrepentantly sullen. Larry could see the drops accreting on the Z's windshield now, as intimations of dawn began to creep into the eastern sky. Dear New York, I've come home. Maybe the Yankees were in town. That might make the trip worthwhile. Take the subway up to the newly refurbished stadium, drink beer, eat hot dogs, and watch the Yankees wallop the piss out of Cleveland or Boston. His thoughts drifted off, and when he wandered back to them, he saw that the light had gotten much stronger. The dashboard clock read 6:05. He had been dozing. The rat was back, he saw. The rat had dug himself quite a hole in that dead cat's guts. Larry's empty stomach did a slow forward roll. He considered beeping the horn to scare it away for good, but the sleeping brownstones with their empty garbage cans standing sentinel duty daunted him. He slouched lower in the bucket seat so he wouldn't have to watch the rat eating breakfast. Just a bite, my good man, and then back to the subway system. Going out to Yankee Stadium this evening? Perhaps I'll see you, old chum, although I really doubt that you'll see me. The front of the building had been defaced with spray can slogans, cryptic and ominous. Chico 116, Zorro 93, Little Abe number 1. When he had been a boy, before his father died, this had been a good neighborhood. Two stone dogs had guarded the steps leading up to the double doors. A year before he took off for the coast, vandals had demolished the one on the right from the four paws up. Now they were both gone entirely, except for one rear paw of the left dog. The body it had been called into creation to support was gone, perhaps decorating some Puerto Rican junkie's crash pad. Maybe Zorro 93 or Little Abe number 1 had taken it. Maybe the rats had carried it away to some deserted subway tunnel one dark night. For all he knew, maybe they had taken his mother along, too. He supposed he should at least climb the steps and make sure her name was still there under the apartment 15 mailbox. But he was too tired. No, he would just sit here and nod off, trusting to the last residue of the reds in his system to wake him up around 7. Then he would go see if his mother still lived here. Maybe it would be best if she was gone. Maybe then he wouldn't even bother with the Yankees. Maybe he'd just check into the Biltmore, sleep for 3 days, and then head back into the Golden West. In this light, in this drizzle, with his legs and head still throbbing from the bring-down, New York looked like a dead whore. His mind began to drift away again, mulling over the last 9 weeks or so, still trying to find some sort of key that would make everything clear, and explain how you could butt yourself against stone walls for 6 long years, playing the clubs, making the demo tapes, doing sessions, the whole thing, and then suddenly make it in 9 weeks. Trying to get that straight in your mind was like trying to swallow a doorknob. There had to be an answer, he thought, an explanation that would allow him to reject the ugly notion that the whole thing had been a whim, a simple twist of fate, in Dylan's words. He dozed deeper, arms crossed on his chest, going over it, and mixed up through all of it was this new thing, like a low and sinister counterpoint, one note at the threshold of audibility played on a synthesizer, heard in a migrainy sort of way that acted on you like a premonition. The rat digging into the dead cat's body. Munch, munch. Just looking for something tasty here. It's the law of the jungle, my man. If you're in the trees, you got to swing. It had really started 18 months ago. He had been playing with the tattered remnants in a Berkeley club, and a man from Columbia had called. Not a biggie, just another toiler in the vinyl vineyards. Neil Diamond was thinking of recording one of his songs, a tune called Baby Can You Dig Your Man. Diamond was doing an album, all his own stuff except for an old Buddy Holly tune, Peggy Sue Got Married, and maybe this Larry Underwood tune. The question was, would Larry like to come up and cut a demo of the tune and then sit in on the session? Diamond wanted a second acoustic guitar, and he liked the tune a lot. Larry said yes. The session lasted 3 days. It was a good one. Larry met Neil Diamond, also Robbie Robertson, also Richard Perry. He got mentioned on the album's inner sleeve and got paid union scale. But Baby Can You Dig Your Man wound up not being recorded. On the second evening of the session, Diamond had come up with a rocking little number of his own and recorded that instead. Well, the man from Columbia said, that's too bad. It happens. Tell you what, why don't you cut the demo anyway? I'll see if there's anything I can do. So, Larry cut the demo and then found himself out on the street in L.A. Times were hard. There were a few sessions, not many. He finally got a job playing guitar in a supper club, crooning things like Softly As I Leave You and Moon River, while elderly cats talked business and sucked up Italian food. He wrote the lyrics on scraps of notepaper, because otherwise he tended to mix them up or forget them altogether, chording the tune while he went, trying to look suave like Tony Bennett, vamping and feeling like an asshole. In elevators and supermarkets, he had become morbidly aware of the low Muzak that played constantly. Then, 9 weeks ago, and out of the blue, the man from Columbia had called. They wanted to release his demo as a single. Could he come in and back it? Sure, Larry said. He could do that. So he had gone into Columbia's L.A. studios on a Sunday afternoon and backed Baby Can You Dig with a song he had written for the Tattered Remnants, Pocket Savior. The man from Columbia presented him with a check for $500 and a stinker of a contract that bound Larry to more than it did the record company. He shook Larry's hand, told him it was good to have him aboard, offered him a small, pitying smile when Larry asked how the single would be promoted, and then took his leave. It was too late to deposit the check, so Larry ran through his repertoire at Gino's with it in his pocket. Near the end of his first set, he sang a subdued version of Baby Can You Dig Your Man. The only person who noticed was Gino's proprietor, who told him to save the nigger bebop for the cleanup crew. 7 weeks ago, the man from Columbia called again and told him to get a copy of Billboard. Larry ran. Baby Can You Dig was one of three hot prospects for that week. Larry called the man from Columbia back, and he had asked Larry how he would like to lunch with some of the real biggies, to discuss the album. They were all pleased with the single, which was getting airplay in Detroit, Philadelphia, and Portland, Maine already. It looked as if it was going to catch. It had won a late-night Battle of the Sounds contest for 4 nights running on one Detroit soul station. No one seemed to know that Larry Underwood was white. He had gotten drunk at the luncheon and hardly noticed how his salmon tasted. No one seemed to mind that he had gotten loaded. One of the biggies said he wouldn't be surprised to see Baby Can You Dig Your Man carry off a Grammy next year. It all rang gloriously in Larry's ears. He felt like a man in a dream, and going back to his apartment, he felt strangely sure that he would be hit by a truck, and that would end it all. The Columbia biggies had presented him with another check, this one for $2,500. When he got home, Larry picked up the telephone and began to make calls. The first one was to Mort Gino Green. Larry told him he'd have to find someone else to play Yellow Bird while the customers ate his lousy undercooked pasta. Then he called everyone he could think of, including Barry Grieg of the Remnants. Then he went out and got standing up, falling down drunk. 5 weeks ago, the single had cracked Billboard's Hot 100, number 89, with a bullet. That was the week spring had really come to Los Angeles, and on a bright and sparkling May afternoon, with the buildings so white and the ocean so blue that they could knock your eyes out and send them rolling down your cheeks like marbles, he had heard his record on the radio for the first time. Three or four friends were there, including his current girl, and they were moderately done up on cocaine. Larry was coming out of the kitchenette and into the living room with a bag of Toll House cookies when the familiar KLMT slogan came on. And then Larry had been transfixed by the sound of his own voice coming out of the Technic speakers. "I know I didn't say I was coming down. I know you didn't know I was here in town. But baby, you can tell me if anyone can. Baby, can you dig your man? He's a righteous man. Tell me, baby, can you dig your man?" "Jesus, that's me," he had said. He dropped the cookies onto the floor and then stood gape-mouthed, stoned, and flabbergasted as his friends applauded. 4 weeks ago, his tune had jumped to 73 on the Billboard chart. He began to feel as if he had been pushed rudely into an old-time silent movie, where everything was moving too fast. The phone rang off the hook. Columbia was screaming for the album, wanting to capitalize on the single's success. Assurances that this would be the biggest record in 5 years poured into his dazed ears. Agents called by the dozen. They all sounded hungry. He began to take uppers, and it seemed to him that he heard his song everywhere. One Saturday morning, he heard it on Soul Train, and spent the rest of the day trying to make himself believe that, yes, he actually had heard it. It became suddenly hard to separate himself from Julie, the girl he had been dating since his gig at Gino's. She introduced him to all sorts of people, few of them people he really wanted to see. Her voice began to remind him of the prospective agents he heard over the telephone. In a long, loud, acrimonious argument, he split with her. She had screamed at him that his head would soon be too big to fit through a recording studio door, that he owed her $500 for dope, that he was the 1980s answer to Bo Donaldson in the Haywoods. She had threatened to kill herself. Afterward, Larry felt as if he had been through a long pillow fight in which all the pillows had been treated with a low-grade poison gas. They had begun cutting the album 3 weeks ago, and Larry had withstood most of the for-your-own-good suggestions. He used what leeway the contract gave him. He got three of the tattered remnants, Barry Grieg, Al Spellman, and Johnny McCall, and two other musicians he had worked with in the past, Neil Goodman and Wayne Stuckey. They cut the album in 9 days, absolutely all the studio time they could get. Columbia seemed to want an album based on what they thought would be a 20-week career. Larry wanted more. The album cover was a photo of Larry in an old-fashioned clawfoot tub full of suds. Written on the tiles above him in a Columbia secretary's lipstick were the words Pocket Savior and Larry Underwood. Columbia had wanted to call the album Baby, Can You Dig Your Man, but Larry absolutely balked, and they had finally settled for a Contains the Hit Single sticker on the shrink wrap. 2 weeks ago, the single hit number 47, and the party had started. He had rented a Malibu beach house for a month, and after that things got a little hazy. People wandered in and out, always more of them. He knew some, but mostly they were strangers. He could remember being huckstered by even more agents who wanted to further his great career. He could remember a girl who had bum-tripped and gone screaming down the bone-white beach as naked as a jay. He could remember snorting coke and chasing it with tequila. He could remember being shaken awake on Saturday morning. It must have been a week or so ago, to hear Casey Kasem spin his record as a debut song at number 36 on American Top 40. He could remember taking a great many reds and vaguely dickering for the Datsun Z with a $4,000 royalty check that had come in the mail. And then it was June 13th, 6 days ago, the day Wayne Stuckey asked Larry to go for a walk with him down the beach. It had only been 9 in the morning, but the stereo was on, both TVs, and it sounded like an orgy was going on in the basement playroom. Larry had been sitting in an overstuffed living room chair, wearing only underpants, and trying owlishly to get the sense from a Superboy comic book. He felt very alert, but none of the words seemed to connect to anything. There was no gestalt. A Wagner piece was thundering from the quad speakers, and Wayne had to shout 3 or 4 times to make himself understood. Then Larry nodded. He felt as if he could walk for miles. But when the sunlight struck Larry's eyeballs like needles, he suddenly changed his mind. No walk, uh-uh. His eyes had been turned into magnifying glasses, and soon the sun would shine through them long enough to set his brains on fire. His brains felt tinder dry. Wayne, gripping his arm firmly, insisted. They went down to the beach, over the warming sand, to the darker brown hardpack, and Larry decided it had been a pretty good idea after all. The deepening sound of the breakers coming home was soothing. A gull, working to gain altitude, hung straining in the blue sky like a sketched white letter M. Wayne tugged his arm firmly. Come on. Larry got all the miles he had felt he could walk, except that he no longer felt that way. He had an ugly headache and his spine felt as if it had turned to glass. His eyeballs were pulsing and his kidneys ached dully. An amphetamine hangover is not as painful as the morning after the night you got through a whole fifth of Four Roses, but it is not as pleasant as, say, bawling Raquel Welch would be. If he had another couple of uppers, he could climb neatly up on top of this eight ball that wanted to run him down. He reached in his pocket to get them, and for the first time became aware that he was clad only in skivvies that had been fresh 3 days ago. Wayne, I want to go back. Let's walk a little more. He thought that Wayne was looking at him strangely, with a mixture of exasperation and pity. No, man, I only got my skivvies on. I'll get picked up for indecent exposure. On this part of the coast, you could wrap a bandana around your wing-wang and let your balls hang free and still not get picked up for indecent exposure. Come on, man. I'm tired, Larry said querulously. He began to feel pissed at Wayne. This was Wayne's way of getting back at him, because Larry had a hit, and he, Wayne, only had a keyboard credit on the new album. He was no different than Julie. Everybody hated him now. Everyone had the knife out. His eyes blurred with easy tears. Come on, man, Wayne repeated, and they struck off up the beach again. They had walked perhaps another mile when double cramps struck the big muscles in Larry's thighs. He screamed and collapsed onto the sand. It felt as if twin stilettos had been planted in his flesh at the same instant. Cramps, he screamed. Oh, man, cramps! Wayne squatted beside him and pulled his legs out straight. The agony hit again, and then Wayne went to work, hitting the knotted muscles, kneading them. At last, the oxygen-starved tissues began to loosen. Larry, who had been holding his breath, began to gasp. Oh, man, he said. Thanks. That was bad. Sure, Wayne said, without much sympathy. I bet it was, Larry. How are you now? Okay, but let's just sit, huh? Then we'll go back. I want to talk to you. I had to get you out here, and I wanted you straight enough so you could understand what I was laying on you. What's that, Wayne? He thought, here it comes, the pitch. But what Wayne said seemed so far from a pitch that for a moment he was back with the Superboy comic, trying to make sense of a six-word sentence. The party's got to end, Larry. Huh? The party. When you go back, you pull all the plugs, give everybody their car keys, and see them out the front door. Get rid of them. I can't do that, Larry said, shocked. You better, Wayne said. But why? Man, this party's just getting going. Larry, how much has Columbia paid you up front? Why would you want to know? Larry asked slyly. Do you really think I want to suck off you, Larry? Think. Larry thought, and with dawning bewilderment he realized there was no reason why Wayne Stuckey would want an arm on him. He hadn't really made it yet. He was scuffling like most of the people who had helped Larry cut the album, but unlike most of them, Wayne came from a family with money, and he was on good terms with his people. Wayne's father owned half of the country's third largest electronic games company, and the Stuckeys had a modestly palatial home in Bel Air. Bewildered, Larry realized that his own sudden good fortune probably looked like small bananas to Wayne. No, I guess not, he said gruffly. I'm sorry, but it seems like every tinhorn cockroach chaser west of Las Vegas. So how much? Larry thought it over. $7,000 up front, all told. They're paying you quarterly royalties on the single and biannually on the album? Right. Wayne nodded. They hold it until the eagle screams, the bastards. Cigarette? Larry took one and cupped the end for a light. Do you know how much this party's costing you? Sure, Larry said. You didn't rent the house for less than $1,000. Yeah, that's right. It had actually been $1,200 plus $500 damage deposit. He had paid the deposit and half the month's rent, a total of $1,100 with $600 owing. How much for dope? Wayne asked. Oh, man, you gotta have something. It's like cheese for Ritz crackers. There was pot and there was coke. How much? Come on. The fucking DA, Larry said sulkily. 500 and 500. And it was gone the second day. The hell it was, Larry said, startled. I saw two bowls when we went out this morning, man. Most of it was gone, yeah, but... Man, don't you remember the deck? Wayne's voice suddenly dropped into an amazingly good parody of Larry's own drawling voice. Just put it on my tab, Dewey. Keep 'em full. Larry looked at Wayne with dawning horror. He did remember a small, wiry guy with a peculiar haircut, a whiffle cut, they had called it, 10 or 15 years ago. A small guy with a whiffle haircut and a T-shirt reading, Jesus is coming and is he pissed. This guy seemed to have good dough practically falling out of his asshole. He could even remember telling this guy, Dewey the Deck, to keep his hospitality bowls full and put it on his tab. But that had been... Well, that had been days ago. Wayne said, You're the best thing to happen to Dewey Deck in a long time, man. How much is he into me for? Not bad on pot. Pot's cheap, $1,200. $8,000 on coke. For a minute, Larry thought he was going to puke. He goggled silently at Wayne. He tried to speak, and he could only mouth, $9,200? Inflation, man, Wayne said. You want the rest? Larry didn't want the rest, but he nodded. There was a color TV upstairs. Somebody ran a chair through it. I'd guess $300 for repairs. The wood paneling downstairs has been gouged to hell, $400. The picture window facing the beach got broken the day before yesterday, $300. The shag rug in the living room is totally kaput. Cigarette burns, beer, whiskey, $400. I called the liquor store, and they're just as happy with their tab as the deck is with his, $600. $600 for booze? Larry whispered. Blue horror had encased him up to the neck. Be thankful most of them have been scoffing beer and wine. You've got a $400 tab down at the market, mostly for pizza, chips, tacos, all that good shit. But the worst is the noise. Pretty soon the cops are going to land. Les flics. Disturbing the peace. And you've got four or five heavies doing up on heroin. There's 3 or 4 ounces of Mexican brown in the place. Is that on my tab, too? Larry asked hoarsely. No. The deck doesn't mess with heroin. That's an organization item, and the deck doesn't like the idea of cement cowboy boots. But if the cops land, you can bet the bust will go on your tab. But I don't know. Just a babe in the woods, yeah. But your total tab for this little shindy, so far, comes to over $12,000, Wayne said. You went out and picked that Z off the lot. How much did you put down? 25, Larry said numbly. He felt like crying. So what have you got until the next royalty check? A couple thousand? That's about right, Larry said, unable to tell Wayne he had less than that. About 800, split evenly between cash and checking. Larry, you listen to me because you're not worth telling twice. There's always a party waiting to happen. Out here, the only two constants are the constant bullshitting that goes on and the constant party. They come running like dicky birds looking for bugs on a hippo's back. Now they're here. Pick them off your carcass and send them on their way. Larry thought of the dozens of people in the house. He knew maybe one person in three at this point. The thought of telling all those unknown people to leave made his throat want to close up. He would lose their good opinion. Opposing this thought came an image of Dewey Deck refilling the hospitality bowls, taking a notebook from his back pocket and writing it all down at the bottom of his tab. Him in his whiffle haircut and his trendy T-shirt. Wayne watched him calmly as he squirmed between these two pictures. Man, I'm going to look like the asshole of the world, Larry said finally, hating the weak and petulant words as they fell from his mouth. Yeah, they'll call you a lot of names. They'll say you're going Hollywood, getting a big head, forgetting your old friends. Except none of them are your friends, Larry. Your friend saw what was happening 3 days ago and split the scene. It's no fun to watch a friend who's, like, pissed his pants and doesn't even know it. So why tell me? Larry asked, suddenly angry. The anger was prodded out of him by the realization that all his really good friends had taken off, and in retrospect, all their excuses seemed lame. Barry Grieg had taken him aside, had tried to talk to him, but Larry had been really flying, and he had just nodded and smiled indulgently at Barry. Now he wondered if Barry had been trying to lay the same rap on him. It made him embarrassed and angry to think so. "Why tell me?" he repeated. "I get the feeling you don't like me so very goddamn much." "I don't dislike you, either. Beyond that, man, I couldn't say. I could have let you get your nose punched on this. Once would have been enough for you."
"What do you mean?"
"You tell them, because there's a hard streak in you. There's something in you that's like biting on tin foil. Whatever it takes to make success, you've got it. You'll have a nice little career. Middle-of-the-road pop, no one will remember in 5 years. The junior high boppers will collect your records. You'll make money." Larry balled his fists on his legs. He wanted to punch that calm face. Wayne was saying things that made him feel like a small pile of dog shit beside a stop sign. "Go on back and pull the plug," Wayne said softly. "Then you get in that car and go. Just go, man. Stay away until you know that next royalty check is waiting for you."
"But Dewey, I'll find a man to talk to Dewey, my pleasure man. The guy will tell Dewey to wait for his money like a good little boy, and Dewey will be happy to oblige."
He paused, watching two small children in bright bathing suits run up the beach. A dog ran beside them, ralphing loudly at the blue sky. Larry stood up and forced himself to say thanks. The sea breeze slipped in and out of his aging shorts. The word came out of his mouth like a brick.
"You just go away somewhere and get your shit together," Wayne said, standing up beside him, still watching the children. "You've got a lot of shit to get together. What kind of manager you want, what kind of tour you want, what kind of contract you want after Pocket Savior hits. If you give yourself some room, you'll figure it all out. Guys like you always do. Guys like you always do. Guys like me always do. Guys like..."
Somebody was tapping a finger on the window. Larry jerked, then sat up. A bolt of pain went through his neck, and he winced at the dead, cramped feel of the flesh there. He had been asleep, not just dozing. Reliving California. But here and now it was gray New York daylight, and the finger tapped again. He turned his head cautiously and painfully, and saw his mother, wearing a black net scarf over her hair, peering in. For a moment, they just stared at each other through the glass, and Larry felt curiously naked, like an animal being looked at in the zoo. Then his mouth took over, smiling, and he cranked the window down.
"Mom?"
"I knew it was you," she said in a queerly flat tone. "Come on out and let me see you standing up." Both legs had gone to sleep, and pins and needles tingled up from the balls of his feet as he opened the door and got out. He had never expected to meet her this way, unprepared and exposed. He felt like a sentry who had fallen asleep at his post, suddenly called to attention. He had somehow expected his mother to look smaller, less sure of herself, a trick of the years that had matured him and left her just the same. But it was almost uncanny the way she had caught him. When he was 10, she used to wake him up on Saturday mornings after she thought he had slept long enough by tapping one finger on his closed bedroom door. She had awakened him that same way 14 years later, sleeping in his new car like a tired kid who tried to stay up all night and got caught by the Sandman in an undignified position. Now he stood before her, his hair corkscrewed, a faint and rather foolish grin on his face. Pins and needles still coursed up his legs, making him shift from foot to foot. He remembered that she always asked him if he had to go to the bathroom when he did that, and now he stopped the movement and let the needles prick him at will.
"Hi, Mom," he said.
She looked at him without saying anything, and a dread suddenly roosted in his heart like an evil bird coming back to an old nest. It was a fear that she might turn away from him, deny him, show him the back of her cheap coat, and simply go off to the subway around the corner, leaving him. Then she sighed, the way a man will sigh before picking up a heavy bundle. And when she spoke, her voice was so natural and so mildly
rightly pleased that he forgot his first impression. "Hi, Larry," she said. "Come on upstairs. I knew it was you when I looked out the window. I already called in sick at the building. I got sick time coming." She turned to lead him back up the steps between the vanished stone dogs. He came 3 steps behind her, catching up, wincing at the pins and needles. "Mom?" She turned back to him, and he hugged her. For a moment, an expression of fright crossed her features, as if she expected to be mugged rather than hugged. Then it passed, and she accepted his embrace and gave back her own. The smell of her sachet slipped up his nose, evoking unexpected nostalgia, fierce, sweet, and bitter. For a moment, he thought he was going to cry, and was smugly sure that she would. It was a touching moment. Over her sloped right shoulder, he could see the dead cat lying half in and half out of the garbage can. When she pulled away, her eyes were dry. "Come on, I'll make you some breakfast. Have you been driving all night?" "Yes," he said, his voice slightly hoarse with emotion. "Well, come on. Elevator's broken, but it's only 2 floors. It's worse for Mrs. Halsey with her arthritis. She's on 5. Don't forget to wipe your feet. If you track in, Mr. Freeman will be on me like a shot. I swear Goshen he can smell dirt. Dirt's his enemy, all right." They were on the stairs now. "Come on, can you eat 3 eggs? I'll make toast, too, if you don't mind Roman meal. Come on." He followed her past the vanished stone dogs and looked at where they had been a little wildly, just to reassure himself that they were really gone, that he had not shrunk 2 feet, that the whole decade of the 1970s had not vanished back into time. She pushed the doors open, and they went in. Even the dark brown shadows and the smells of cooking were the same. Alice Underwood fixed him 3 eggs, bacon, toast, juice, coffee. When he had finished all but the coffee, he lit a cigarette and pushed back from the table. She flashed the cigarette a disapproving look, but said nothing. That restored some of his confidence, but not much. She had always been good at biding her time. She dropped the iron spider skillet into the gray dishwasher, and it hissed a little. She hadn't changed much, Larry was thinking. A little older, she would be 51 now. A little grayer, but there was still plenty of black left in that sensibly netted head of hair. She was wearing a plain gray dress, probably the one she worked in. Her bosom was still the same large comber blooming out of the bodice of the dress. A little larger, if anything. "Mom, tell me the truth. Has your bosom gotten bigger? Is that the fundamental change?" He started to tap cigarette ashes into his coffee saucer. She jerked it away and replaced it with the ashtray she always kept in the cupboard. The saucer had been sloppy with coffee, and it had seemed okay to tap in it. This ashtray was clean, reproachfully spotless, and he tapped into it with a slight pang. She could bide her time, and she could keep springing small traps on you until your ankles were all bloody and you were ready to start gibbering. "So you came back," Alice said, taking a used Brillo from a table talk pie dish and putting it to work on the skillet. "What brought you?" "Well, Ma, this friend of mine clued me into the facts of life. The assholes travel in packs, and this time they were after me. I don't know if friend is the right word for him. He respects me musically about as much as I respect the 1910 Fruit Gum Company. But he got me to put on my traveling shoes, and wasn't it Robert Frost who said home is a place that when you go there they have to take you in?" Aloud, he said, "I guess I got missing you, Mom." She snorted. "That's why you wrote me often?" "I'm not much of a letter writer." He pumped his cigarette slowly up and down. Smoke rings formed from the tip and drifted off. "You can say that again." Smiling, he said, "I'm not much of a letter writer." "But you're still smart to your mother. That hasn't changed." "I'm sorry," he said. "How have you been, Mom?" She put the skillet in the drainer, pulled the sink stopper, and wiped the lace of soap suds from her reddened hands. "Not so bad," she said, coming over to the table and sitting down. "My back pains me some, but I got my pills. I make out all right." "You haven't thrown it out of whack since I left?" "Oh, once, but Dr. Holmes took care of it." "Mom, those chiropractors are..."
"Just frauds.
He bit his tongue. A what? He shrugged uncomfortably in the face of her hooked smile. You're free, white, and 21. If it helps you, fine. She sighed and took a roll of wintergreen lifesavers from her dress pocket. I'm a lot more than 21, and I feel it. Want one? He shook his head at the lifesaver she had thumbed up. She popped it into her own mouth instead. You're just a girl yet, he said with a touch of his old bantering flattery. She had always liked it, but now it only brought a ghost of a smile to her lips. Any new men in your life? Several, she said. How about you? No, he said seriously. No new men. Some girls, but no new men. He had hoped for laughter, but only got the ghost smile again. I'm troubling her, he thought. That's what it is. She doesn't know what I want here. She hasn't been waiting for 3 years for me to show up after all. She only wanted me to stay lost. Same old Larry, she said. Never serious. You're not engaged, seeing anyone steadily? I play the field, Mom. You always did. At least you never came home to tell me you'd got some nice Catholic girl in a family way. I'll give you that. You were either very careful, very lucky, or very polite. He strove to keep a poker face. It was the first time in his life that she had ever mentioned sex to him, directly or obliquely. Anyway, you're going to learn, Alice said. They say bachelors have all the fun. Not so. You just get old and full of sand, nasty, the way that Mr. Freeman is. He's got that sidewalk-level apartment, and he's always standing there in the window hoping for a strong breeze. Larry grunted. I hear that song you got on the radio. I tell people, that's my son. That's Larry. Most of them don't believe it. You've heard it? He wondered why she hadn't mentioned it first. Sure, all the time on that rock and roll station the young girls listen to, WABC. Do you like it? As well as I like any of that music. She looked at him firmly. I think some of it sounds suggestive, lewd. He found himself shuffling his feet and forced himself to stop. It's just supposed to sound passionate, Mom, that's all. His face suffused with blood. He had never expected to be sitting in his mother's kitchen discussing passion. The place for passion's the bedroom, she said curtly, closing off any aesthetic discussion of his hit record. Also, you did something to your voice. You sound like a nigger. Now? He asked, amused. No, on the radio. That brown sound, it sure do get around, Larry said, smiling. Just like that, she said, nodding. When I was a girl, we thought Frank Sinatra was daring. Now they have this disco. Disco, they call it. Screaming, I call it. She looked at him grudgingly. At least there's no screaming on your record. I get a royalty, he said. A certain percent of every record sold. It breaks down to... Oh, go on, she said, and made a shooing gesture with her hand. I flunked all my maths. Have they paid you yet, or did you get that little car on credit? They haven't paid me much, he said, skating up to the edge of the lie, but not quite over it. I made a down payment on the car. I'm financing the rest. Easy credit terms, she said balefully. That's how your father ended up a bankrupt. The doctor said he died of a heart attack, but it wasn't that. It was a broken heart. Your dad went to the poorhouse on easy credit terms. This was an old rap, and Larry just let it flow over him, nodding at the right places. His father had owned a haberdashery. A Robert Hall had opened not far away, and a year later his business had failed. He had turned to food for solace, putting on 110 pounds in 3 years. He had dropped dead in the corner luncheonette when Larry was 9, a half-finished meatball sandwich on the plate in front of him. Then Alice brought Larry up, dominating his life with her proverbs and prejudices until he left home. Her last remark to him as he and Rudy Schwartz drove off in Rudy's old Ford was that they had poorhouses in California, too. Yes, sir, that's my mama. Do you want to stay here, Larry? She asked softly. Startled, he countered, Do you mind? There's room. The rollaway's still in the back bedroom. I've been storing things back there, but you could move some of the boxes around. All right, he said slowly. If you're sure you don't mind. I'm only in for a couple of weeks. I thought I'd look up some of the old guys. Mark, Galen, David, Chris, those guys. She got up, went to the window, and tugged it up. You're welcome to stay as long as you like, Larry. I'm not so good at expressing myself, maybe, but I'm glad to see you. We didn't say goodbye very well. There were harsh words. She showed him her face, still harsh, but also full of a terrible, reluctant love. For my part, I regret them. I only said them because I love you. I never knew how to say that just right, so I said it in other ways. That's all right, he said, looking down at the table. The flush was back. He could feel it. Listen, I'll chip in for stuff. You can if you want. If you don't want to, you don't have to. I'm working. Thousands aren't. You're still my son. He thought of the stiffening cat, half in and half out of the trash can, and of Dewey the deck, smilingly filling the hospitality bowls, and he suddenly burst into tears. As his hands blurred double in the wash of them, he thought that this should be her bit, not his. Nothing had gone the way he thought it would, nothing. She had changed after all. So had he, but not as he had expected. An unnatural reversal had occurred. She had gotten bigger, and he had somehow gotten smaller. He had not come home to her because he had to go somewhere. He had come home because he was afraid, and he wanted his mother. She stood by the open window, watching him. The white curtains fluttered in on the damp breeze, obscuring her face, not hiding it entirely, but making it seem ghostly. Traffic sounds came in through the window. She took the handkerchief from the bodice of her dress and walked over to the table and put it in one of his groping hands. There was something hard in Larry. These tears couldn't change that any more than a single summer cloudburst can change the shape of rock. There was something that gave you the bitter zing of biting on tinfoil or hearing chalk scree on a blackboard. Deep inside, looking out, was only Larry. He was the only one allowed inside his heart. But she loved him. She also thought there was good in Larry, great good. It was there, but this late on it would take a catastrophe to bring it out. There was no catastrophe here, only her weeping son. You're tired, she said. Clean up. I'll move the boxes and you can sleep. I guess I'll go in today after all. She went down the short hall to the back room, his old bedroom, and Larry heard her grunting and moving boxes. He wiped his eyes slowly. The sound of traffic came in the window. He tried to remember the last time he had cried in front of his mother. He thought of the dead cat. She was right. He was tired. He had never been so tired. He went to bed and slept for nearly 18 hours.